designed by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which is what we're working on right now. It's very narrow. For them, it's physicians, mid-level practitioners only. There are broader definitions of primary care that go down to support levels quite a ways below that, which to me is a more intelligent way of thinking about primary care.
That first recommendation too, there's no reason why that can't be focused specifically on primary care providers. There's no reason why it can't include allied health professionals and psychiatric workers, dentists, pharmacists, any group that the committee might identify as.
I guess one other comment is that I just wondered how your activities coordinated with the health service recruiter activity, because I know they've been probably the most successful at recruiting primary care physicians in the state. I know they do a mailing to every family practice graduate in the country every year. And they've actually been quite successful in recruiting those people into the state. Are you coordinating with those?
Well, we're not really providing any recruitment retention services at all at the state level. This program is just focused on doing primary care planning for the state. If there were a program developed, which was my third recommendation, to provide recruitment retention services, that program would have to work real closely with the Indian Health Service program to coordinate. I know that that's a real successful program. I don't mean to dispute it at all, but I was surprised as I went through the physician surveys. I mentioned that a majority of those noting a need for recruitment retention were rural physicians. There were a number of physicians from the 638 contractor corporations that noted a need also, and that surprised me a little bit just because I know they have a real effective program.
Well, I think retention continues to be a major problem out there.
Very possibly will always be.
I guess what I'd like to do, it's already time, is to have Dr. Doty go ahead and make her comments and then have a more general discussion because the answer too relates to her activities. So go ahead and make a comment you're going to make and take your other comment.
Get the sound off this one. Just in response to that data, that was provided to me from the recruiter at AMC. Over this most recent year in recruiting, they were successful in recruiting a total of 20 out of 20 family physicians in non-acreage-based areas. They have 20 more physicians to recruit for the next year. Their retention problem is a big one.
Retention, right.
I'll give you a little background of who I am. I'm a physician who works out in the Matsu Valley. I'm a graduate of the WAMI program and came up here in 1978, left, did all of my training, and ended up coming back to Alaska. And I work now doing as a family physician doing obstetrics out of Valley Hospital out in the Valley. I've been there about 7 years now. My first year I spent at the Indian Health Service System, so I have some familiarity with how it works too. Some people don't identify the Matsu Valley as rural. If you look on a national identification of what rural is, there's real various definitions. And I just returned from a rural health fellowship in Tennessee where we spent a day trying to define what rural meant. The definition is not real clear and is used differently in different areas, but I think under most arguments, anything outside of Anchorage is considered rural in Alaska. I'm currently working on a project to develop a residency training program in Alaska, and I'd like to give some background on that. First of all, most non-medical trained people do not have much of an idea of what a residency program is. It's a post-doctorate training program after 4 years of medical school, specifically designed in the specialty, in this case, of family practice, as opposed to obstetrics or pediatrics or internal medicine. There are, I think, a total of 40 now specialties and several subspecialties that one can go into. The concept of this is something that is not new. It's been worked on since as early as the early to mid-70s. Has been unsuccessful in being developed in the past for many, many reasons, including difficulties with coordinating a large state, identifying what the needs are, having differences between urban and rural demands for physicians, and this is specifically a physician training program. There is a lot of national emphasis to reevaluate our primary care physician training and specifically there's some funding we put into looking at developing more family physicians in particular who are well trained to deal with the rural issues of rural health care. At this fellowship that I attended, I'd like to present some just brief data which may be helpful on a national basis of why rural physicians are in trouble right now as far as recruitment retention goes. The first part is presented from Bruce Behringer, who's currently the chairperson of the Office of Rural Community Health, but he's also head of the National Rural Health Association. He's coming to Alaska in about 3 weeks, October 9th, for the Rural Health Conference is coming up. And this is national data that he's worked in Washington, D.C. and several other areas, and looking nationwide and what's going on in physician recruitment in rural areas. Basically, 25% of the U.S. population is non-metropolitan. That's 50,000 or less, which in Alaska, you take the top three cities, and you've got much smaller populations than that. 25% of general and family physicians in the United States are over 65 years old, and 45% over 55 years old. Your pool of physicians are aging. On top of that, recruitment of other areas of primary care, such as internal medicine, pediatrics, have a very small rate of return to rural areas. It takes, in internal medicine, approximately 11% of the internal medicine graduates go to a rural area. Approximately 4.5% of the pediatric graduates go to a rural area, with that definition being 50,000 and less. Obstetricians, less than 10%, go to non-metro areas. Nurse practitioners, non-physicians, 15.8% are in non-metro. Metro in 1988, these are 88 statistics. That's down 18% from 1984. So in all areas, we're having difficulty in recruiting well-trained people comfortable in rural settings. Registered nurses, 17% practice in non-metro areas. The aging issue is a real one, and when you look at what we're producing as far as physicians go in the United States, we are, the definition of primary care usually incorporates pediatrics, internal medicine, family physicians, and in some cases obstetricians, depending on what definition you're using. The U.S. overall produces about 25% of its graduates in primary care. Canada produces over 50%. Of that 25%, only 10% of those are family physicians. So you have a pool of graduates of approximately, it's about 8,000, I believe, graduates a year. Of family physicians to be distributed throughout the United States, and a large percentage of those are now being recruited into more urban areas. Family physicians have been targeted as being more cost-effective for groups like HMOs and prepaid health plans, who put their, and physician assistants and nurse practitioners are being utilized this way too, as their gateway to admission. You know, you cannot go to an orthopedist until you get a referral from your primary physician. Because of that, there's a lot of pressure on these graduates to go to areas where there's high income, low responsibilities as far as call, and low responsibilities as far as obligations to the community. And those opportunities are very enticing to the graduates. So what the rural areas are now doing is competing with those graduates. Kaiser Permanente in California has issued a mandate that they would accept 10 to 25% of all family practice graduates into their system alone. Certainly not a rural program. So there's a nationwide competition to select off the physicians that are probably best suited to train and be retained in rural areas. One of the reasons why family physicians have been targeted for rural areas is because their curriculum, which was established in 1972, is specific for being able to be a generalist, to be able to deal with the trauma stabilization and transport, deal with obstetrics. The majority of babies in the United States are still delivered by family physicians and not by obstetricians. Seems like that's not the case, but it is true because we have a large population of the U.S. that is rural. And Alaska is no exception. We have a bit of a quandary in the system the way it works because the public system through the Indian Health Service and the military centralizes their deliveries, but those people are often flown in from rural areas. So if you live in Naknek and you're native, you don't deliver in Naknek, but you do deliver in Anchorage. So there's some skews, and when you look at some of the statistics about what's going on, that gets thrown off. I've been working with a cooperative lately with several stuff, been working with the WAMI Medical Education Program at the University of Alaska. I've been also been working with the Alaska chapter of the American Academy of Family Physicians, which really represents the it represents all family physicians in the state, but a lot of the membership that's active is are in the area that Deborah is addressing, in the private practitioners in Cordova and Valdez and Homer and Kodiak, in small communities that are primarily private serviced rather than public. We have had, over the last year, a series of planning meetings, first one of which was held about a year ago, where we had physicians from all over the state come in and have basically a planning session and input. What would a postgraduate training program in Alaska look like? The two messages that came across was, one was to be strongly rural component in it, and the second would be that it would be pertaining to the cross-cultural and specific issues of living in Alaska. In order to have an accredited program, it has to be accredited to the ACGME, which is the accrediting program that accredits all types of postgraduate training in medicine, including obstetricians and pediatricians and cardiac surgeons. That committee has a residency assistance program advisory committee and very strict guidelines about what constitutes a well-put-together program. And there's a booklet of about 40 pages of criteria that one must accomplish in order to get a certified program. The process takes 3 to 5 years. It requires specifically inpatient training for approximately the first 12 to 15 months. In other words, the physicians must have hospital-based training in pediatrics, in internal medicine, in obstetrics, through a specific number of requirements. They also must have a continuity clinic, a family practice center that provides a continuity clinic for which the individual can learn to care for people in a family model over time. And that's the key that is different than any other residency training program as far as what it takes to provide family practice training as opposed to other areas. It's also the key to why it's a good training program for rural areas and specifically because of the fact that you develop some continuity, some relationships with patients. New models have developed recently looking at how to put a continuity clinic in a more rural setting. To accomplish the hospital-based acute training program as required, but also to look at setting the continuity clinic in a more rural basis, and thus accomplishing what's often referred to as the affinity model of recruiting and retaining physicians. In other words, if you continually expose professionals in training to a rural setting and allow them to be comfortable in that environment, over time, they will learn some skills, as including with a curriculum, in being comfortable in that setting. And that's been directly related to the retention and satisfaction of practicing in a rural area. One of the concepts that we're trying to promote with this training program is, first of all, to look at the hub of Alaska as the site for the initial intensive inpatient training. The hub is clearly in Anchorage. We have looked at other sites and populations, and in this state, we only have a population that can support a residency training program with the kinds of intensive care training needed is probably Fairbanks, and it's kind of borderline as far as the numbers of physicians and the complexity of patient care that's available there. The continuity clinic is a component that could be expanded out into other areas, particularly regional. There are some programs that have put one resident into a community of 3,000. That's the far end of the scale. Other programs put residents into a community of 10 or 15,000 and put two residents together so that they can interact with each other. There's a program currently in Kentucky being developed partly by Wayne Myers, who spent a long time running the WAMI program in Fairbanks. His program uses video two-way telephone communication to give some of the didactic curriculum and to try to get rid of the isolation issues of an individual and training in remote areas. That's a model that would be very feasible to apply in a training program in Alaska. This program would, by necessity, be a three-year program. There are now fellowships beyond the 3 years that are being developed in other areas for focused training in obstetrics or in trauma stabilization, other areas beyond it. But it's basically 3 years beyond medical school. school, so it's an additional 3 years. Residents are typically paid for their time as residents. In return, they're on salary, and their services can be billed for. Physicians can be licensed after 1 year of training. In other words, the first year is 3 years, they're usually in a supervisory situation, but their services can be billed for the second and third year. That's a cost advantage in the sense that you can put a physician in Nome or Juneau, I mean, in an organized and supervised training program, but you can maybe offset the cost of training that individual by some of the charges related to their services provided. Now, some people may say, well, why do we need to train physicians at all in Alaska? We've got lots of other areas to focus on, and I would agree with the fact that there is a very broad-based healthcare system up here. Physicians in general need to provide supervision, and you need to have some sort of a pyramidal system where you've got usually physicians as the coordinating person at certain levels. And I learned that very well in the public health system, watching the village health aides and the hierarchy of the pyramidal system through the public health service. We are having some trouble retaining physicians in areas that are more remote and less connected with an organized system. And I think Deborah has addressed some of that. Lots of populations that are not surveyed very often, and that's why some of the issues that are different between Manny and Deborah's data are present, I think. You don't see the public sector versus the private sector differences because the private sector frequently is not addressed. I have a very busy and growing community out in the valley. I don't know if the state statistics show a growth rate in the valley of 6% compared to 2% approximately for the state as a whole. And my particular practice has recruited for approximately 3 years for someone who wants to do family practice, work hard, work long hours, make less money than you'd make in Anchorage, and partly because of overhead and malpractice costs, and do obstetrics. And that's not because we don't have a good practice. It's because it's very difficult to access those issues about recruitment. Why does the residency program help that? Well, for one thing, statistics on residents that graduate, 80% of them stay within 25 miles of where they trained. And those statistics have held true when you look at all types of residency programs. Alaska has no training programs formally that are for the full 3 years. There is a relationship between one of the physicians in Ketchikan and the University of Washington Family Physician Training Program, where the physician comes up for, I believe it's a 2 to 6 month period of time. The only existing training program formally right now for this particular population. It's a couple of arrangements with general surgery, with ENT, which are subspecialty areas. Those people, though, are going to settle in populations that are probably a minimum of 15,000 in the area. Not going to serve a small community. Where are we in this planning program now? Like I said, it's a 5-year program, minimum, as far as planning and getting things up and running. It takes startup costs to get the initial survey and the curriculum development done. And we're in the process right now of looking at how to organize that. Where could you put a family practice center? Where are the medically underserved populations that could benefit from this service in particular? How to go about recruiting and hiring faculty that are well-trained and can develop the issues about rural practice. There's a lot of issues to be addressed, and it's a step-by-step process to go through. Okay. That's a brief summary of what we're trying to accomplish. I think I'll stop there and see where we can go from there.
I'm wondering if, assuming that we're sold on this idea, Jody, if number two addresses, in one of the recommendations, addresses the recommendation.
It'd be very easy to develop a program that incorporates rural and underserved areas. Anchorage clearly has a medically underserved population that's not totally being addressed right now. We have talked to the Neighborhood Health Center, which is currently the only well-organized facility that addresses that population specifically. They've had a mandate to try to, they feel that they're addressing only 25% of the medically underserved population in Anchorage alone. Because we have to have a certain component of this program in a
resource area that has a lot of technology, we would have to put the first part of this program in Anchorage. It would be very easy also to develop an expansion program for the second and third year into more rural areas. But I think number two does address that.
Dan.
Yeah, I would like to add to what Dr. Dooley has said and what Devin has said, but step back a little bit. There's a big problem with how to assess our need in this area, and it goes to the problem of lack of information that is a systemic problem in Alaska. We have not had a comprehensive statewide planning apparatus in place since the dissolution of the health systems agencies and the dissolution of the State Department of the Division of Planning, SHPDA. And what exactly does letter of the day remember that? SHPDA is the actual State Health Planning and Development Agency, I think that's what it was. There's just not a lot about what we don't know about our system. We don't know, we have a hard time linking up need with what the actual health status problems are going on in here, with appropriate levels of provider power and where they should be. We don't know why physicians and mid-level practitioners and other primary care providers leave. There's no accident information gained from them as they leave. Some states have this in place. North Carolina has a very sophisticated system of information gathering about where physicians go every time they change their license, why they left, how long were they there, where did they go to school. Just a whole lot of information about provider behavior that we don't understand. And it's not enough to talk about ratios of physicians to population. That doesn't get you any place. That's more about want than about need. We need to look at ratios of physicians and other providers to population, but within a context of understanding where our health needs actually are. Dr. Nakamura is working on some of that in his division. But we need to expand this, and I'm going to talk to you about this again tomorrow, but it seems to me that our ability as a state to understand our health need and our health environment and our health provider environment is severely compromised by the fact that we do not have a health planning system in place. And I would remind you that in April and May, the Alaska Health Summit launched a major resolution toward the state, toward state government, recommending the construction of such a system. We do not have a system in place. It's a major flaw in our understanding of what our problem is and what to do about it. I would add that in the list of three areas that Deb has stated here, number three, we have a clearing house and we have an operation going on that is some of this. It's called the Rural Alaska Health Education Center, which is an adjunct, or it's actually tied to the AHEC that operates out of the University of Washington School of Medicine. And we're coming to the determination of that funding.
that we want to be looking at, and we asked this, and maybe for the benefit of Senator Ellis, number one on this list includes the endorsement of the recommendation we already have on record for the support of the student.
Yeah, I plan to reintroduce that bill yet again.
Yes.
We're calling it the Northern Exposure Bill.
But we've already had some kind of assistance with the malpractice, particularly as it relates to OBGYN services.
Just an interesting note, when I was at the Rural Health Conference last month, I compared notes with a physician in Indiana, which has relatively low malpractice costs. She pays to do family practice for the obstetrics $8,000 a year and has no additional financial obligations if she leaves the state of the practice. My malpractice has peaked at $38,000 a year, and I have to pay an additional $50,000 to $75,000 if I leave the state. Malpractice is a big problem in this state.
Barbara, in your remarks, how much would it cost to have a practice residency up here? And the second question, we're talking mostly about access now. The task force has talked a lot about hospital payment. If you recruit better for rural areas for physicians and other health professionals, does that lower or raise overall state medical costs?
Having a center of training that's postgraduate in our state should lower the cost of malpractice to a certain degree because it provides an access point for continuing education. One of the issues about rural practice is access to continuing education, to updated information is limited. And through a training program, particularly getting rural physicians involved in faculty and faculty development issues, improves the quality of practice throughout the state by improving the quality of those particular individuals and making access to instructors and information and providing a network system that is more likely to get that information out sooner. The initial question you had about cost is something that I can't give a hard dollar value, but I can tell you most programs estimate that the cost per resident is about $100,000 per year when you talk about a resident's salary that runs about $25,000 to $28,000, the cost of maintaining the faculty, facilities, etc. The $100,000 a year, however, is usually offset by about 70% in revenues generated by that individual over the 3 years. The first year revenue generated by physicians in their internship year or first year of residency is not real significant. Second and third year, though, it seems to be. And in the rural areas, rural track cut programs like they have in Spokane, where there's a physician that trains for their second and third year in Caldwell, Washington, it's a break-even situation. That individual's billing seem to offset the cost of maintaining that individual in the community and training. So there are creative ways to address that. There are some other financial resources in cost when you look at federal grant monies, which are starting to open up. The Health Manpower Office in Washington, D.C. is actively trying to put money into developing such programs. There is a differential in reimbursement rates for hospitals that are involved in training programs, and this applies very clearly to Medicare. Medicaid is state by state, and one of the issues that might be considered is to look at our state's Medicaid reimbursement and to consider looking at that in a differential for a teaching institution. Those are called direct and indirect reimbursements through Medicare. It's a very complex system, but that particular system tends to pay the institutions for the cost of maintaining the resident program and will reimburse at a higher rate the billing cost for that individual patient. And that is a significant source of revenues to offset the cost of residency care. In our state, if we develop a residency training program, because of the complexity of our state and the need for cross-coverage,
doing that, you can limit the excess cost of unnecessary transport because of lack of expertise in identifying who should be transported and who should not be. Obviously, medical transportation costs in this state are extraordinarily high. I know that the Native Medical Center in Anchorage has been very successful in their MCH program by identifying women that are high risk in pregnancy and providing adequate care and getting them into town in a non-emergent manner before delivery rather than transporting them emergently. That significantly cut their costs. So I believe there's several ways that the answer to that. I personally feel that this is clearly a cost-containing issue, particularly if you look at the competition for family physicians nationally. People are identifying family physicians as cost-effective caretakers who can put some barriers up to expense and say, no, we can handle this here. They're particularly trained to deal with about 85-90% of common medical illnesses that arise, and to interact in a consultative and transport method for that 15-20% that are too complex to handle in a routine office or a small hospital setting. So it should definitely be more cost-effective, but I can't quote statistics for you.
Okay.
Since it is a national problem, apparently, what amount of encouragement are we giving to either the Congress or to medical schools to crank out more? The problem is not that every single doctor coming out can't find work. They obviously can find work. They can then choose between whether they want to make $1 million the first year or $500,000, or they really want to go to work in the rural area. So as a consequence, has anybody looked at the numbers of docs we're cranking out today? How does it compare with the number of docs we were cranking out at the end of World War II, as an example? And why aren't we doubling or tripling the number of medical schools out there instead of sending our young people? I have two just out of the southeast region that I represent currently doing their studies offshore U.S. because they can't get into these medical schools. Their dad wasn't a doctor.
That's an excellent question. Bruce Berenger addressed that, and it was very, very frustrating. He used to be in charge of health manpower for the National Health Service Corps, and now is currently not in that area, but is involved in development. And if you look at funding for medical education on a national basis and how that gets transmitted through, a very large emphasis is placed on research and National Institutes of Health type monies. A very small portion of that, probably a 20th to a 100th of the dollars that go into the National Institutes of Health go to primary care development. And the monies that get sent to these medical schools then are targeted for those particular research development subspecialty technology areas. Hence, we're not being very good at producing primary care resources.
Another partial answer to your question, Senator Jarvis, it's hard to keep them on the farm once they've seen Parikh. And what we've seen in figures for even those systems that are graduating, a lot of primary care providers, and furthermore, who had more or less a rural flavor, still the attraction to the drift of technology toward the mega centers is irresistible in terms of personal income and personal and professional satisfaction. So it really takes measures like the primary care, the residency efforts that Barbara's talking about. It takes identifying initially people who have personal family experiences in from rural areas. As we find that a high number of people who actually practice in rural areas are themselves products of small towns often. But we also see that the initial fit, as Deb was saying, you know, was the initial recruitment effort a rational one? Or was it based on something like neural exposure?
And yeah, just to throw out one more quick statistic on this, Dr. Koop mentioned last night that, like I mentioned earlier, 20% of the physicians in the country are primary care physicians. In Great Britain, 70% of the physicians are general practitioners. In Canada, 50% are. Dr. Koop mentioned that if tomorrow all medical schools in the nation
we license physicians. We don't have to continue to allow the AMA to keep a closed shop monopoly so that every doc coming out of school has the capability of making $1 million in Seattle, Washington. All you got to do is change the licensure, and we can start cranking out docs like crazy. Now, maybe most of them are going to be speaking a foreign language, and English will be their second language when they get here. But I'm really tired of being held hostage by a bunch of prima donna medical schools. And if, in fact, the statistics bear that out, and I think they will, we've seen significant growth in population without any significant change, and, in fact, a deteriorating change in the numbers of primary care practitioners coming out of our medical schools.
I think it's larger than medical school, Senator. I think it's more systemic than that.
It may very well be.
It is.
I'm only suggesting that there may be just maybe an opportunity that Congress could, and that the states joining with them could, change the licensure very radically. Now, that may very well impact quality and level of care. When you start looking at communities the size that I represent, who may very well not have a doctor at all, having somebody that speaks French may be much to be preferred as to have no physician in the community that you can turn to. So I think that many of us are getting very frustrated and very willing to take a look at some radical changes in this entire system. That's why I've asked to be on the board. I'm very frustrated.
I'm not aware of the direction of public health. I agree that the direction and the focus should be on shift between specialty care and primary care as far as physicians and medical schools go. The problem may not be solved by cranking out many more doctors. The problem may be better addressed by changing the healthcare delivery system to focus on another, and when we do have these practitioners who are not physicians, but are more than capable of having much of that 80% of primary care needs identified.
Yeah, that was one thing I was
going to
mention was many of the states are addressing right now. In terms of this problem is, and it's not really mentioned in the articles that are attached either, but a lot of them are looking at amending their licensing procedures to allow the double practitioners to provide more services. Alaska leads the nation in that area now in terms of licensing with mid-level practitioners and allowing them to provide services at that level and be primary care providers, and they're a very, very important part in Alaska, the primary care delivery system, especially in rural areas and especially in the isolated communities are large enough to support a provider at that level, but still not large enough to support a higher level provider.
Rob, I'm Senator Kerr, in sympathy with you and the rest of us in terms of trying to get a better mix of primary care physicians. I think the problem rests largely with the federal government telling the medical schools, because the medical school deans themselves don't seem to be getting very far in doing anything about this. They must sort of crank out more family practitioners. I take exceptions to two things you said. One is if you triple the number of medical schools, the problems that we're facing about cost and access will be triple. The cost will certainly be triple. The second thing is I take exception to your statement that there are very many doctors making $1 million a year. It must be a tiny fraction of the doctors in the country that make $1 million a year. I never heard of a doctor going into the first year of practice making $1 million. Maybe you can find a cardiac surgeon who does, but I think that's a ridiculous statement.
I guess what I get at is you're saying that and want to ask the committee about these three recommendations, whether they feel comfortable with them, what is it that we could are in advanced practice areas, but only 9% of those who are in advanced practice choose to practice in rural areas. And that is dramatically lower than other national medical schools that choose to focus in this area. So, you know, the issues in Alaska are, there are a lot of issues to be worked on in this area. I've said my, any other comments? Comment on two points here. About 15 years ago, when the state had an acute shortage of social workers, the state implemented a plan whereby students could go to the University of Idaho and they were tuition free. The state paid tuition plus gave those students a stipend. The payback for that was that the graduating student would return to Alaska and work 4 years in rural Alaska. I think if we're going to offer some incentives, we should go back and look at the successes and failures of that program. I don't know how it was. I do know one student who entered that program that came out of the program after 2 years, and even though she was a native student, decided that she did not want to commit to 4 years in rural Alaska. Did end up getting her master's degree in social work and ended up working in Juneau. So that might be a program to look at, is to see if there's some successes or failures that you might want to either buy into or to avoid in some kind of incentive program. The other thing is my understanding, I think I'm right on this, that if you're going for a postgraduate degree, that the amount of state loan you can get is less than if you're going for a bachelor's degree. I think we need to, if that's the case, we need to look at that, because I know there are several nurses, for example, who would like to become nurse practitioners who can't afford to leave their job and go back to school. And while it certainly would be preferable to have a physician in every community, until such time as that's possible, nurse practitioners may fill some kind of gap.
Other comments from committee members?
Okay. I think what we'll do is ask our expert panel here to look at these recommendations and maybe refine them. And then we'll send out to everybody again if you want to get them. And Rob, we'll see what we can do about your comments. Other items on our agenda. One of them will be Dr. Nakamura's, which we'll switch from the last item on our agenda to the next one. And then we take a break. And then we'll come back for another 10 or 15 minutes and then we'll be done. So, Dr. Nakamura.
Thank you. This is Jay Mongol. The last time I had the opportunity to try to present the picture of public health, try to define what public health was, what the state's role in public health happened to be, and the impact of public health on cost, attainment, access, and the role of public health. adherence of the essential public health services are the core functions of the public health system that must be established and maintained as a foundation for an Alaskan state public health program based on the principles of health promotion, health protection, and disease prevention. Under the section called Access, I would add a third statement which states that access must also apply to those population-based services that promote prevention, health protection, and health promotion. As far as recommendations, I'd like to start with a couple of three statements. The first statement is that the ultimate mission of any healthcare system should be to preserve and achieve maximum individual and public health. Healthcare reform that focuses only on the principle of cost containment, access, and healthcare financing can be successfully attained without addressing the overall mission of the healthcare system. Decreased costs and increased access can be attained while providing inappropriate, ineffective, and irrational healthcare. It is critical that the population-based health services that are funded on the principles of health protection, health promotion, and disease prevention be included and coordinated with individual-based services when addressing health care reform. To assume that services are appropriate for bringing about public health, it is essential for the state of Alaska to invest in a public health agenda that guarantees the establishment and permanency of the core public health functions of, again, assessment, policy development, and assurance of essential individual and population-based services. Without these, any direction will be undirected. Public health cannot be attained without the participation of the individual, the community, the private health sector, and the public health care system. But the state has a unique responsibility to assume that the core public health functions are available in the cloud. My recommendations based on those statements are as follows. One, stress the achievement of public health as a driving principle of healthcare reform and do not limit considerations to cost containment, access, and financing of health care. Two, commit the state of Alaska to a public health agenda that establishes public health services as the foundation of any healthcare reform package. Three, charge the State Department of Health and Social Services with the responsibility for developing the core public health functions of assessment, policy, development, and assurance. Assured personal and population-based services are to be justified by their impact on the quality of public health and their influence on cost containment and access to essential health care. Four, encourage the state to guarantee support for the fiscal requirements of the public health agenda approved and endorsed by the citizens of Alaska and their elected policymakers. Funding for those core functions that have been determined to be essential should be taken out of the competitive arena for health resources and protected as a necessary foundation of Alaska's health care system. Those recommendations I made obviously from a very narrow public health oriented focus that I feel that they are essential to be addressed in any health care reform discussion. Thank you.
So, Dr. Napoli, I understand this first document would be revision of guiding principle. Second document are the subcommittee recommendations.
There's all my
recommendations. Right, but they would be the subcommittee recommendation. Okay. And Rod, I guess I want to ask you at this time, you had some materials that you developed, the list of services. Is that relevant at this time?
Well, Rod Wilson, I think so in a way. Just a comment on the principles, as you all know, we're going to talk about those tomorrow morning, and perhaps we can consider Dr. Nakamura's additions to the principles at that time.
That sounds good to me. Sounds like a good
meeting. The other thing, I think, is statements about about public health, and the recommendations are good ones and perhaps ones that we should, as a subcommittee, consider adopting. On page 2, recommendation 3, the second sentence in 3, starting to ensure the personal population, seems a little murky to me, but that aside, the thing that I had prepared has just been distributed, Karen.
The murkiness must make up with use of population-based services. And population-based services are generally related to public health services. In other words, it addresses the health of communities and a large population groups, such as implementation of the immunization program or public health services, health education, educating the community to be responsible for their health.
Okay, Rod, I think everybody has a copy of the items that you passed out.
Yes, I did, mainly for my own entertainment and perhaps yours too. And I just listed as illustrations some of the things. I'm sure I've left out some that I think government should do with respect to health. Government should do this mainly because nobody else is going to do them. And they're perhaps overly specific for our needs here, particularly in light of Peter's nice general statements. But I just wanted to list for any of those who wanted the kinds of things that government should do, in my opinion. And they're not couched, particularly under the health education, in the usual language and words that are used for that kind of thing.
I just wanted to say that I think Dr. McMurray's presentation was a good presentation. And I think that the guiding principles that you, the additions that you suggested are well worth considering by this task force. I think that's maybe one area that we've overlooked and not discussed enough. I may not be able to be here tomorrow because of my schedule, so I want to be sure to make that statement now. I think those should be given very careful consideration as possible additions. I had the opportunity earlier this week to make a presentation to the what's the name of the group, Nancy? South Central Foundation. And they had reviewed the report. I passed out the review of the report. And one of the areas they thought that we had overlooked, quite honestly, was this whole area of basic services that help prevent disease and so on, and that we should have that included in our report as a recommendation. There are certain governmental functions that we should be taking care of, drinking water and waste disposal, et cetera. And honestly, as you look at the recent articles in the Anchorage Daily News, it's quite clear to me that that's where you really start this whole, with some very basic services to prevent disease and illness. So I would recommend that we, maybe this subcommittee makes a recommendation, that we consider that as an addition to our final report to the legislature, that there's some very basic services that we need to be sure are taken care of and provided to the population of the state. That's part of our responsibility. So I think it's very timely, and I just quickly glancing at the two new principles that you have, Doctor, I think they make a lot of sense. Something should be considered, as well as your other recommendations to task force. I hope that as we develop our report, that we spend some time looking at them.
Other comments from the task force? Go ahead and take Rod's advice on and have these guiding principles come in front of the group as a number, as change one, would you make any kind of revisions that you think are necessary, and then we'll send these out?
For,
that would be my, my...
When?
My goal is that we get recommendations all together in a package, and that I'm sensing that it would be fine to include these recommendations in our draft for review. But if you have some concerns about some of the language, you might want to clean it up for us. Would that be all right?
Is that for your report tomorrow, or?
No. I'm thinking that we, sometime between now and the next meeting, we have a draft done. Is that an acceptable thing to do with the subcommittee? Okay.
So,
let's take a break. My memory was that we also were trying to address the issue, the bigger question, which of course cannot be answered, but at least we put on the table, I think, was the result of our discussion, is what happens to systems like the email service if there is universal access or near universal access? What kinds of role would that system play in a global budgeting process or in any of our assumptions about how the system is built? I guess my feeling is we haven't really gotten to any conclusion, intelligent conclusion about that question, but I think identifying it and putting it out in the report is pretty important because somebody's going to have to deal with it at some point quite soon, or
Rod Wilson, does that mainly have to do with the crossover, or whether that can legally or morally or any other way be curtailed? Or
I think the issue, Rod, really goes back to Larry Bartlett's comments originally on whether or not when you're looking at universal access provisions to care, whether it's an all-payer system or pay-or-play system or whatever, whether the Alaska Native population is really included in that system or they are considered somehow separate and outside that system. And again, I think that there are different incentives depending on whether the people reside in a rural area where there's a sole provider as a federal hospital right now, or whether they reside in Anchorage where they have, where open access would mean radically different things. So I think that the organizations themselves and the Native community is still trying to come to some terms of what that would mean to understand it.
Jay?
I was going to suggest there are some reforms going on in Hayward, New York, and the board is talking about it.
This is Jay Liney. There are some reforms that have been going on in New York and Minnesota and talked about in Florida and some of those states. I think that have would have Indian Health Service beneficiary populations. I wonder if any of those states have talked to the Indian Health Service or have dealt with the payment aspects of what's been anyway.
Yeah, in preparation for my report last time, Jay, I called the three different individuals in Minnesota. The executive director of the Minneapolis Health Board, the executive director of the Minneapolis Health Board, the area director for the Minnesota area, and also a rural provider in Minnesota in a health service system. And they basically, all three had different opinions on the impact and the desirability of the Minnesota reforms. The only thing I did find out was that Minnesota had excluded the federal funding from the provider's tax. That had been a special provision in the Minnesota reform, and that in Minnesota they had made certain special provisions to set that system outside, but there was real no uniformity on what that, and since that has not been fully implemented either. People are still trying to anticipate what that effect would be.
David, didn't Minnesota, though, in addition to excluding the federal expenditures from providers' tax, also exclude the federal expenditures from the global budget?
Yes.
I mean, it's just not under that limit at all, right? They've set it aside and trying to decide how to handle it in all aspects.
So it's a hemispheric budget, not a global budget. Anybody's plan, but maybe over the course of a dozen or 20 years, if the predominant plan can be proved superior, other systems would be phased into it.
Okay, I guess we've gone as far as Canada this year. I guess there's nothing in my kind of thinking and moving on to the final item, which is how are we going to wrap up what we talked about here. I guess there's nothing wrong with, in my mind, having some narrative which talks about what we looked at, and at least
you have a comment?
Okay. All right. How are we going to get this department? Oh, me?
You.
Well, yes, can you describe just again what the timelines are? I believe you agreed at the last meeting you were going to get the recommendations to the task force members a week before the October meeting. So that means if we're going to put them in the packet, I probably need it 10 days before the October meeting. I think then the task force would have a month making their final recommendations in November, and then the report issue as soon as it can be, you know, the final changes are made late November or early December. I would say with regard to writing this report that tomorrow morning I'm going to present a brief outline of the final report. And Larry and I put that together, and it is written from the perspective that it's going to be read by people who don't have a lot of time and who are not not knowledgeable of these issues. And so there isn't going to be a long, detailed explanation of the problems and the recommendations. I think at least what we're proposing would be conceptual as they were in the interim recommendations, probably a little bit more detailed than we had in interim recommendations. So you might want to consider that as you think about writing the subcommittee report.
Okay. That means...
Make it so legislators can understand.
Lots of pictures. Big print.
Okay, the I guess I will, given that, the fact that our narrative might be as short as 2 pages, I would be willing to do the writing, most of the writing, but I would, on the condition that I get some material from some basic suggested paragraphs from David on the Indian Service System, and anything that Rod is going to add to what Dr. Moore had on the public health system. And anyone else who wishes to volunteer in any way, do any writing, please don't hesitate to let me know. But what we can do then is I'll just take those paragraphs and I'll incorporate them in some way into a text. I'll send out, we'll get the, we can just help the recommendations that we reviewed today and get that out to you maybe in about 2 weeks, and that would mean that we would need to either meet face to face at some point during our next meeting or by teleconference. And if she's saying that we need to send this out in a packet 10 days in advance, which maybe we ought to consider whether we really need to do that. Might be pretty hard to do.
Yeah.
With regard to the recommendations on retention and recruitment and retention, I already asked Deb and Debbie if they were Deb and Demi if they would write the problem statements there too. So I think perhaps again, we're not looking at pages, we're looking at paragraphs. So I think that, and I certainly can help you too in terms of perhaps writing some of that, or at least trying to get people to write some of the paragraphs.
So would it be, under those circumstances, would it be possible for us to try to not send this out of the packet and try to get, just so we have a little bit more comfortable time frame to get the table and present it group, you know, just pull, you know, okay. And that, then what is our preference? Is our preference to have a short subcommittee meeting by teleconference prior to our next meeting to go over the
teleconference?
And our meeting is the 22nd and 23rd of October. What about the 19th, Monday the 19th? Okay. Any,
I don't know. When is it? October 18th holiday. Is it Friday or Monday?
The 19th is Monday. I don't see any. 18th
is holiday. Holiday.
Yeah, the Alaska Day.
Yeah. Oh, it's Alaska Day?
Yeah.
17, 18. Oh, it would
be on the calendar. Is it Friday or Monday?
Anybody else that wants to sit in on that is welcome. Right now it's just Jerry, Billy, and myself, because the other people are not here.
Tricia Gorman in Anchorage. We're going to begin our subcommittee hearing on public information. Do we have anybody online from another community?
Yes, you have
Phil.com. I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Soldotna.
Thank you. And who is in Soldotna?
We have Jump and Schrader.
Thank you.
Homer's online.
I am.
Thank you. And who's in Homer?
Mary Raymond.
Hello, Mary. Jerry Neer is with us from the Kenai Peninsula, and Rod Wilson, Dr. Rod Wilson is here from Anchorage, and Jay Levy is here from Juneau, and Nancy Cornwell is with us.
Thank you.
I'm going to say hello.
Well, go ahead. Say hello.
Yeah, it's Jerry Neer.
I guess, Nancy, maybe at this time, we could just, should we just go over what the activities are that are planned? That is as much as I was thinking we would do. I can, do either one of you folks have our agenda that lets you know what other agency people are coming to this task force meeting? Would you like me to just quickly tell you who those people are? We're having, I didn't hear any response, but I'll go ahead. Okay. Tomorrow we have a number of different presentations by interest groups that were either by our invitation or by their request, and they include the Kenai Peninsula Borough Healthcare Advisory Council is coming. There is a pharmacist from the Alaska Pharmaceutical Association. There is a representative from the Alaska Chiropractic Society, a physician from the pediatric group here in Anchorage. Denny DeGrasse is coming, who is president of the Alaska Public Health Association. There is a dentist coming from the Dental Society. There is a representative coming from the Health Committee on the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. Someone from the Alaska Native Health Board will be speaking. There's a person coming from the Alaska Public Interest Research Group, and that is those are the different groups that are coming to this meeting. In addition to that, we have another 13, is it, Nancy, scheduled for October.
I'm going to pass these out so you can just take one and turn this to one.
Possible for them to come to one of the town meetings, even though they are presenting from, I think we could provide them with that option. They may not want to do that. I think they have to be given the same limits that I think in all fairness that the other people come to those meetings, but they could be provided that opportunity.
Yeah, I think that's right.
They may not like that.
I think, however, though, that you're going to run across, I mean, groups are going to find out that certain groups came forward, and they're going to say, well, you let so-and-so come forward. Why not me? And I'll just have to handle those calls as tactfully as possible. We're just out of time. The task force has the 23rd, or has the October meeting and the November meeting, and that's it. Final recommendation.
Nancy, I appreciate that you have done really a major portion of this public information. You really have been the committee. And I guess if you want to maybe lighten up that load a little, if you get agencies who are really wanting to bend your ear, i.e. complaining, maybe we ought to just say that it would be, I guess I'm asking the rest of the committee, if you want to say, here are one of five people you can call. I am the project director. Here are the task force members. If you really have a real big gripe to air, call one of these five people and let them bend one of our ears. I guess I'm wondering what other people think about that in terms of taking a little bit of that off of your back.
Well, so far it's not been I've just kept scheduling people. I've tried to tactfully tell people that, where the task force has been, where they are in terms of looking at the bigger picture, because I'm concerned that I'm concerned that some of what you're going to hear is going to be not on the subject. It's not going to help you in terms of writing the final record. Not going to be related to, the more general issues that you have dealt with. Some of them I think are going to be right on, and I really strongly try to encourage groups to think about where you've been and to try to tailor their comments so that they can be helpful to you in writing their recommendations.
I think, though, that we're going to have to listen to part of that. And hopefully, if people get, they need to stay within their time frame, and if they get too far off track, then that's up to the chair to maybe bring them back on.
This is Rob Wilson. You say there's a lot of groups that are calling you to want to be heard, and I certainly would like give them the opportunity to be heard, because we want people to understand what we're doing, and maybe we're certainly going to want them to buy on later when we get further down the road in terms of trying to implement something. I hate to see people turned away. I would be willing to listen to people on Saturday, October the 24th. Maybe one or two other people on the task force from Anchorage would be willing to do that too, if that would accommodate a few more people, a few more groups.
at this point, have you had to turn anybody down yet, or are you just anticipating that's going to start happening?
I haven't turned down anyone yet. I just, if you look at those, if you look at the schedule, in the last week, I've added the top six. Okay. Because we were hoping, keeping this, and it's actually sort of...
You mean the October? In the last week, you've added
week.
The top six of the October group.
Right.
Okay.
And what happened, you see, I started scheduling after lunch on the 23rd there, and so it's the organizations who waited the longest were actually going to get the task force in the early part of the day, which is sort of bad. I don't know if you can really sit through these or this many presentations very successfully. I just think that after a while, it's just hard. I mean, lots of subjects, lots of different groups, and you know, just it can weigh on your attention span, I think. And I'm not sure whether it's fair to add, you know, any more. I mean, I'm not sure it's fair to the groups to have this many scheduled in one day, because those were the instructions. I asked the introductory representative Elvis, I said, should I schedule more of them on the 23rd, or should I move to the November meeting? And they said they all have to go on the 23rd, and this is what happened. I think that... So
let me just get this straight in my mind. So that our meeting on the 22nd is for the whole task force, and all of the 23rd is this?
Starting at 9:15.
Okay. I think it is a tough schedule, but I think we're certainly capable of handling it. I guess I think what will tend to happen is that some of us, your interest will kind of, it'll be like a little roller coaster, and that there'll be people who will key in.